www.similibus.org. Also, for those of you who would like to read more about Dr. Taylor's work, there's an extensive article series up on the Whole Health Now website, which is www.whole health now.com. And if you go to the home page there across the top, you'll see a link that says Taking the Case with Will Taylor, and there's a really lovely 15-part series there that you can read and really get a sense of the depth of Dr. Taylor's work in homeopathy. Also, there is a fabulous cured case, video cured case available on the Homeopathic Symposium of Dr. Taylor's, and I highly recommend that you check that out as well. And the URL for that website is www.homeopathicsymposium.com. Okay, so Will, thank you so much.
There's a slideshow tutorial on plant families up there as well.
Yes, thank you very much. Yes, there's actually more than that. On the Homeopathic Symposium website, there's a cured case. There's also a fabulous multimedia tutorial on plant families, and there's also a number of multimedia tutorials on various remedies from our Materia Medica. So there's a lot of very valuable information on all three of these websites, Will's website, thesimilibus.org, the Whole Health Now website, which has that article series, and the Homeopathic Symposium website. Okay, so, Will, thank you again for taking the time out of your schedule to join us. Let me go ahead and just start by just asking you generally, I know Hahnemann has cautioned against the use, somewhere in his writings, I know he cautioned against the use of using botanical affinity to discern the medicinal property of plants. And I kind of know you as being somebody who is fairly Hahnemannian in their approach. So I'm curious, how do you justify this interest in plant families?
Sure. Well, you know, to start out, Hahnemann was quite a botanist. He had translated several books on botanical medicine and a book on the economic plants of Germany. So he was very familiar with botany. And of course was well versed in the pre-homeopathic use of botanical medicines in old school medicine in which he was originally trained. So that background was very, very solid for him. And of course, a lot of his early colleagues, Benninghausen, actually took care of a botanical garden in Germany. And so the knowledge of botany was widespread among these early homeopaths. And I think we have to look at the context of the caution that those who tried to diminish the value of botanical families use, the quote of Hahnemann that they always refer to. And this was in his Essay on a New Principle, which was 1796, and really was the first public birth of homeopathy. And in this article, he goes through and says, how are we going to systematically determine the medicinal use of a substance so that we have good, solid, reliable knowledge in a relatively short period of time to build up a materia medica? And he went through and basically said there are shortcomings in any method until it comes to doing provings on the healthy and using the property of similars. This is a systematic method, which is our surest method of determining medicinal properties. And in here, he says, he brings up the question, can we use botanical affinity? And he says, well, it isn't terribly reliable because we can find many examples of closely related plants with very different medicinal effects. And yet he goes beyond that. And the part of the quote that most people don't manage to get to is he says, but I'm far from saying this doesn't give us some interesting information. It especially gives us good information with which to organize our knowledge of materia medica. And that's the manner in which I like to use botanical families. So although I wouldn't suggest that we can immediately discern the properties of a plant just based on botanical relatedness, there certainly is something of value here. And Hahnemann goes on in his Materia Medica, for example, in the proving descriptions of remedies to give many examples. In introducing Ignatia, he says, first off, we shouldn't be surprised that it resembles Nux vomica closely because it's in the same botanical family as Nux vomica, and so on. So I don't think there's any point where he says this is a useless kind of endeavor.
Well, you know, Will, of course, I know that you really love this integration of using botanical families and homeopathy. And, of course, it's not the way that I was personally trained, and so I've always had lots of questions about it. And for me, one of the big issues, of course, is reproducibility, that the fact that you know, people who describe these symptoms associated with a particular family or taxonomical grouping are fairly consistent. And, you know, going through the literature, you know, specifically relating to the, and I'm sorry if I'm giving you challenging questions here, but you're definitely the person to ask these questions to. And you know, through a number of different teachers, reading the description of the lily family, I saw really very different types of descriptions, and I think there were actually three different ones that I saw. So I was curious, what do you make of this? The fact that there's these different descriptions of the symptoms associated with the family of the lilies.
Yeah, well, the first thing I would do is not do what's so often done with homeopathy and say, oh, my goodness, there's controversy, nobody can agree, somebody must be wrong. That's the first place I would not go. But what I would do is to say that any generalization we draw about a family, any general generic description, for example, of the lily family, is in formulation now. We're at a very early stage of trying to say, what are the general features of this family of remedies? And, of course, the Materia Medica is huge. Any remedy has multiple faces, and any one teacher or investigator in this area is going to find different pieces to emphasize and focus on. And so in this very early stage of saying, is there a general collection of symptoms that belong to the lilies as a group, we're in this very early stage of investigation. And so I think it's only natural that the principal people looking into this area and teaching about this are going to come up with conflicting stories, or at least superficially conflicting stories. And my spin on this is that it's too early for us to take these generalizations and say the lily family's like this, and so our case has all the symptoms of the lily family, so we're going to restrict our analysis to the lily family. I think we're too early in this process of investigation to really do that. And so I take a very different approach to working with plant families in this. And rather than trying to be one more person to add my spin on what the lily family is like, I'd rather use the, do classical kinds of analyses and then look for connections. So, for example, I do an analysis on a case of chronic headache with nausea and vomiting and a lump in the throat from the nausea in the headache. And I take all the characterizing symptoms, the characterizing totality of the case, six or eight symptoms, and repertorize them up. And I see that somewhere in the top 10 remedies are three members of the lily family. Okay, and there are different ways to recognize this. And this is when I would say, hey, what about looking at the lilies seriously? Because we don't know any of these remedies thoroughly. You know, we don't know any of the lilies with the thoroughness with which we know sulfur or calc carb or pulsatilla. So it's not a surprise that none of them come up first in our analysis. But the fact that three of them come up in the top 10 or 15 remedies maybe is a hint that as a group, the lilies cover this whole case. And so that's where I start focusing on a plant family. And again, there if you don't know what remedies belong to which families, there are some ways built into, particularly now built into radar, that permit you to identify that rapidly.
You know, I have to say, of all the different ways of utilizing botanical families and homeopathy, I really find yours to be the most practical and the most really on the table, not really off the edge of the table. So I really find it to be I still have certain personal reservations, but I can see what you're doing. I've seen you do it in the seminars, and I've seen you produce results in your practice with it. So, you know, obviously there's something to this, and I want to really applaud you for the very grounded and cautious manner in which you're utilizing this vast amount of information and trying to improve our success in practice.
Thanks, Kim. And as you know, we've had these conversations about conservative homeopathy and kind of progressive and exploratory homeopathy. And I think it's very important that there are people walking out to the edge of the table and, you know, for example, trying to make a generalization about what the whole lily family is like, as an example. I think it's important, and I think it's not important yet that they necessarily be correct, okay? I think it's important that people are asking these questions and investigating it. It may be early to take those generalizations and apply them in practice. So, you know, I take a more conservative approach in my practice, but I'm intrigued by the people walking out to the edge of the table, and even the people who it feels may be falling over the edge into idle speculation.
I think
there's a value for them within our community. You know?
Sure.
We don't know where the edge of the table is until
sure.
we can clearly define that people are going past it.
Sure. Well, you know, Will, I think what might be important, especially for the students, is a recognition that this is still very new and that we don't really have clearly defined understandings of these various taxonomical groupings and how they relate to homeopathy. Well, because I do see people just kind of spitting this off as dogma, and that definitely does concern me.
Right, and there's a perspective that's interesting to take, in that although there's a very modern and contemporary focus on botanical families, it really isn't necessarily new. You know, we know that, you know, Benninghausen clearly was well-versed in botany. Several plants are named after this fellow. I think about 20 different plants bear his name in some form or another. Ernest Farrington in the late 1800s organized his Materia Medica lectures by botanical family and brings in a number of examples of concordances of medicinal properties within a family. Alphonse Testi in the 1850s in France developed his families, his groupings of remedies, of which botanical affinity was one of many factors he considered in creating these groups of related remedies. So people have been working on this a long time, and I think it's intriguing that these careful researchers didn't come up with obvious and easy-to-use conclusions, and we're revisiting this today. And of course, there are people who are adopting this as you know, the work of some of the contemporary teachers as dogma and using it, but it's too early to do that. You know, I think this is just part of this ongoing process that some of these introduced ideas are going to persist and some won't, and we have to find out which are valuable and stay with us and which are not valuable and are discarded.
So, you know, Will, I normally don't like to have people who we interview comment on other practitioners' work, but I feel in this case it's really necessary because we're talking here about botanical families and their use in homeopathy, and pretty much the person who seems to be spearheading this movement or one of the principal players in this movement is Rajan Sankaran, who's developed a model for utilizing botanical families in homeopathy. And so I thought maybe I could just ask you to comment a little bit about that. For those of you who are not familiar with this work, basically the idea is to find not the remedy that the person needs, but the botanical family that the person needs, and then also to determine which of 10 different miasmatic groupings that patient is in, and then to kind of cross the miasm, the botanical family, with one remedy within that botanical family that fits the miasm for that particular patient. And so the idea here is that there's one botanical family that in each of the botanical families, one of the remedies is associated with one specific miasm. In other words, there's 10 miasms, so within that botanical family, there would be one remedy fitting into each of these miasms. And my question, of course, is that there's a lot more remedies within these botanical groupings than there are 10 miasms. And so I'm curious what you think about this model, this approach, and if you don't feel comfortable with this question, just let me know as well.
Yeah, I think it's a really, you know, it's a really intriguing idea, and I think Rajan is a very brilliant man. He's a very creative thinker, and I think it's really very creative of him to come up with this idea and investigate it. And I think even Rajan would agree that his work here is investigational. And the biggest concern I would have with this is someone does his seminars or reads his books and says, "Oh, this is gospel," and starts using it as proven stuff. you know, as those of you who followed Rajan over the past, you know, 15 years know that he quickly adopts a fascinating question and plumbs it to its depths and sometimes keeps, you know, his conclusions and sometimes follows his track for a while and then discards, you know, his whole idea of court illusions he was focusing on for a long time, and I think it gave us some very valuable work, but he's pretty much discarded that now and he's not playing with it anymore. And yet I think those of us who kind of follow him can kind of pick up the sweepings and say, hey, well, there was some stuff of value here. Let's keep this and this. Yeah, forget about that. And I think it's going to be the same with this work. I think to start with the notion that within any family there's a representative of each of the miasms there's nothing that would suggest intrinsically that this is true. And for example, when I look at a family like the Conifera phyta, I don't understand why those are not all considered psychotic. And he breaks them down and says this one is psychotic, this one is cancerinic miasm, and this one is syphilitic, and so on. And yet I look very carefully at those remedies, and they really all feel very psychotic to me. So don't take that as gospel truth either, but weigh these two pieces of suggestion against each other, you know. So you can have Taylor here saying, I think they're all psychotic, and Sankaran saying, I think they break down this way. And then I'd like you to study all those remedies and come up with your own conclusions. And you may agree with neither of us or adopt part of each of what we have to say. And I think the most valuable outcome is that you will have studied the Conifera phyta and understand them in much greater depth when you've done that, and improve your skill at prescribing some of the smaller ones. But you know, I see within them all the severe sense of personal inadequacy, the global sense of isolation, forsakenness, the inability to disclose that we see classically in the psychotic miasm. Of those that have been around a while and we've got clinical evidence, we see warts in them. Those that have been more recently introduced, we're not going to see warts in improving. So it's going to take clinical experience until we know if those are symptoms of Agathis australis or some of these other more recently proved
drugs. Well, can you just let people know that you're talking about conifers as opposed to angiosperms?
Oh.
Because people may not be familiar with the term.
Oh, the Conifera phyta, which is the order, the botanical order of the conifers. Here, which includes Thuja as our best-known remedy, and then a number of other, Sabina as the second best-known, and then a number of other rather poorly described or recently proved conifer trees.
Okay, I just a quick question about that. If you finished,
mm-hmm.
but if you haven't, go keep going.
That was a good spot.
Okay, so just a quick question about that, which is you were talking about the conifers as being a grouping that Dr. Sankaran would group different remedies into each of his miasmatic classifications.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about that because here you've got a level within the taxonomical hierarchy that's at the order level, whereas mostly when we're talking about these groupings, we're talking about the family level, Solanaceae, Compositae,
yeah.
You know, Umbelliferae. So how, can you just explain that to me? Because that's a little confusing to me.
Yeah, well, there are a couple places where we get creative about our groupings. You know, for example, if we wanted to stay at the family level, at this smaller groupings of the taxonomic grouping of families within plants, if we wanted to stay at that family level with the conifers, we would have one family with several members, the Cupressaceae, which includes Thuja and Sabina and a couple other poorly known remedies. And then we have the Pinaceae, which includes a few extremely poorly described remedies. And then we have the Araucaceae, which has only one member. And we end up with groupings that just aren't useful for us. So, you know, when we create a quote, family grouping, really what we want is we want to narrow our focus to kind of a useful collection of remedies. And if we narrow our focus too small, we're going to miss things that are important. So, you know, I think it's useful for us to sometimes to broaden our scope a bit. You know, to have three or four extremely poorly known members in a quote family unquote group is a useless family for it. It really doesn't help us out in our daily work. So sometimes it helps to expand our focus a bit and say, instead of focusing on the various families of conifer trees, let's expand that and look at the ordinal level. And in fact, I like to expand that just a little bit more. The conifers are non-flowering plants, and we have very, very few of these in Hermitia medica. Basically, they're the conifers. And then there's lycopodium, and then there's ginkgo and ephedra that we know very, very little about homeopathically. So and then a couple of other very obscure things. So basically, of reasonably known remedies, we have lycopodium sitting in its own family all by itself, and family work isn't helpful at all to it. But when you think for a minute, I know when I first studied homeopathy and we studied Thuja, the first thing my teacher said was, think of it as a left-sided lycopodium, and then let's go from there, you know. So I like to add lycopodium to the conifer group and expand that family a little bit more and really talk about the non-flowering plants or the gymnosperms. Those terms aren't synonymous, but they're close to synonymous to each other. Just to expand our scope a little bit and allow us to use the pretty obvious medicinal relationship of lycopodium to the conifers to help us understand this group a little bit better. Similarly, in the lilies, the group kind of generally known as the lilies is actually a collection of families that botanists have tremendous arguments about. I always think of the Gary Larson cartoons or the butterfly catchers trying to name these things and, you know, killing each other over the rights to a name. And I think this really goes on in botany. So it's a very confusing grouping of remedies, and it's maybe useful for us to just kind of lump all of these families together and work with them as a whole, because otherwise we have a number of very small families with only poorly understood members in them.
Well, we're using a lot of terminology that I'm assuming that maybe some people on the call are not familiar with.
Oh, okay.
Are there resources available that help people to understand botanical classifications or just family classifications of our homeopathic remedies?
Yeah, there's several. I think one place to go to that's relatively easy is to open up the family's repertory in RADAR and go to the kingdoms subgroup of the family's repertory and then look under the plants. And you'll see there that there are three different systems of botanical classification. Maybe we could talk about that a little bit more, but pick any one of them for now. And there you can see the relationships of the remedies and their organization into families. So that's one place. Another place is, it's a very good book by Vilma Bharatan. I think I'm pronouncing her name correctly. It's Bharatan. And Vilma has worked with the Kew Botanical Gardens in England with the botanical taxonomists there, and produced a little book called Plant Names in Homeopathy, an annotated checklist of currently accepted names in common use. And basically she did work very similar to what I did in constructing the RADAR database, is had to go back and find the names of many of our plants, find the currently accepted botanical names, and classify them into their families. And it's a very nice little book. The third resource is a book actually published in the Czech Republic, and although the title is Czech, you know, the botanical names are all Latin. So once you figure out which column means family, and that's pretty easy, and which column means remedy, you learn a little Czech in the process. You've learned three Czech words, and then the book is useful to you. But it's by Jana Balakova, Jana Bolekova. And it's got a kind of a complicated name, Systematizace Leku. I won't do the rest of this and embarrass myself with my poor Czech pronunciation. But I think that both of those are, I think that in your bookstore, Kim, both of those are being carried now.
Oh, we carry those?
I know that Vilma's book is, and
okay.
I know that they were looking into Jana's book.
And okay, so for those of you who might be interested, I'm not sure if we carried both these titles or maybe just one of them, but you can try Allison, toll-free number 866-599-5950. That's 866-599-5950. And talk to Allison, and if she doesn't have those books, I'm sure she can lead you to the place where you can locate them.
And if you're looking for the checkbook and can't find it, drop me a note, my email address on my website, and I'll direct you to a source on that. Although I think Allison was trying to get that.
Okay, great. That sounds good. Any other resources that you wanted to mention?
I think those are the best.
Okay.
Now. I think that you'll find, and again, you know, for example, in Sankaran's plant book, you're going to find a number of errors of classification, and I don't mean that as criticism. I think Rajan is putting his energy into some really good areas, but he's not a botanist, and don't hear that critically. But if you want some good information on classification, I'd go to these sources first.
Okay, great. Thank you, Will. Will, you mentioned that there are different systems of taxonomical classification. I know there's the Dahlgren-Cronquist and Uppsala systems. Could you kind of just inform people about why there's these different systems and what's different about them and why is this important to us?
Yeah. Well, botanists for the past couple hundred years have been working hard to figure out how we really classify plants in a useful and pragmatically useful way and theoretically useful way. Up until recently, this has really been based on structure, both growth structure and microscopic structure of plants, and using this to infer evolutionary relationship. But of course, we know that two things, like a bat and a bird, can look very much alike, but have converged and developed those characteristics independently. So just because two plants resemble each other very closely in many characteristics does not necessarily mean they're related to each other. So these are the classical systems, and the two in most common use are by Cronquist and Dahlgren. There are some others that are basically variations of those two, and they're rather similar to one another. There's some significant areas of difference in particular areas. More recently, folks have started using DNA analysis and analysis of proteins to identify what might be more accurately the evolutionary relationships of plants. And there's a group called the Angiosperm Phylogeny Group, or the APG, also known as the Uppsala group, which have developed a system of classification based on this. And when I put together the radar database, I put a lot of time into wondering about which of these systems to use to classify. And finally, I decided that it made sense to use all three. And so I built three parallel databases. And you'll find that in many places they agree, and in many places they disagree. One of the most important things where they most often don't disagree on what sits in any one family. Where they most often come into disagreement is which families are closely related to other families. And this becomes important in some areas for our remedies. I find in my own work that sometimes I think if your interest is at a beginning or intermediate level, I'd stick with the Uppsala system. But once you get rather sophisticated in working with botanical families, I think it sometimes is helpful to look at all three systems, because sometimes you'll find a relationship between remedies that one system would not have predicted.
Will, I notice that when you're looking at botanical families, Solanacea and Compositae and Primulaceae and so on and so forth, that oftentimes you'll find, for example, that each one of these different botanical families all has a tree in it. Like, you know, the fact that a plant is a tree doesn't necessarily tell you which botanical family it's coming from. So why is that?
Right. Well, trees have been an independent invention of many different botanical families have discovered how to make trees. So trees are not necessarily all related to each other. And the most obvious example would be the conifers and the hardwoods. Have you know the conifers are of the non-flowering plants, the hardwoods are all of flowering plant groups. So there's a very fundamental difference here. But even, for example, a beech tree and an apple tree, which superficially might look, you know, pretty similar in many respects, are separate inventions of these different families. So, you know, looking at trees as a group becomes a, you know, it's an interesting question. Is it a useful group for us or not? It certainly does not, you know, it pulls together a collection of remedies that have no botanical evolutionary relationship to one another. Does the superficial form of the remedy provide some relation, you know, in other words, does a tree of one family have anything to do with a tree of another family? Does treeness confer a particular medicinal property? I think that's an interesting question that I don't think is resolved. So, you know, does the, quote, family of trees, unquote, is that a useful family for us to use? I don't know. I think the cards are out on that.
And what about just things like, you know, remedies that come from flowers or fruits or vines? Same type of thing? Or?
Yeah, the same type of thing. I think we have included a lot of those groups in the, some of these were in the existing families database before I took a look at it, but I've kept them and expanded that a little bit so that if we want to, we can limit an analysis to only whole plants in flower or only the fruits of plants, you know, and, or only the roots or only trees and so on, to these artificial or analogic groups that we can kind of define. And I think it'll be an interesting question of, do those groupings provide useful information for our purposes? And I think the cards are out on that. We don't fully know that yet.
Well, Alphonse Tessier wrote about the natural habitat of remedies being a useful characteristic on which to group remedies, like, for example, you know, remedies coming from mountainous terrains or remedies mm-hmm. coming from damp valleys, et cetera, et cetera. Do you find such groupings useful?
Well, I find this really fascinating. And Tessier threw in a little piece of, he didn't come up with this, I think this is a piece of traditional folklore, that the notion that we can find the remedy for our ill in the environment in which the illness occurs. I think this is fascinating, for example, when we think of a disease like Lyme disease and discover that Lyme tends to be prolific in areas that are very rich in the heath family plants, and also find that the heath family plants, Ledum, Kelmia, Rhododendron, Gaultheria, are some of the most important, if not the most important, remedies in the treatment of Lyme. So, you know, the notion that, that the remedy for this disease exists in the environment in which the disease exists, it's an intriguing and alluring hypothesis. So Tessier played with this, and one example that I think is a really excellent one is looking at Veratrum album and arsenicum, which we know when we study these remedies, particularly with respect to their acute illnesses, their dysenteries, diarrheal illnesses, that often they're extremely difficult to distinguish from one another. They both have the collapse, the coldness, the cold sweat, you know, the vomiting and diarrhea simultaneously, et cetera. And very often when you're looking at a case of dysentery like this, it's very difficult to decide between the two of them. And Tessier made the observation that Veratrum album is overwhelmingly the appropriate remedy in those societies that are more mountainous, which happens to be the environment where Veratrum album is an alpine meadows plant, whereas in the damp valleys, where arsenic is often prevalent in the soils and in the water supply, arsenicum is much more commonly the remedy for the diarrheal illnesses in seen in those societies. I think it's a fascinating idea, and I don't know that there's if it's generally true or not, but it's an intriguing one to look at and keep our eyes open for. I wouldn't limit myself to the selection of a remedy on this basis, but I find it an intriguing piece for observation.
Very interesting. Well, just a very quick whimsical kind of question. I heard you mention the remedy Ledum. Everybody's familiar
uh-huh.
with Ledum. It's a common remedy for first aid situations and acutes. And I know that you had mentioned that it has a different name now, that the botanists are calling it to something entirely different. I thought you could just share with the group what Ledum is now called.
Yeah, well, Leadum is now Rhododendron tomentosa.
I love it.
So it's been put into the genus Rhododendron, and if you've seen Leadum in bloom, it's obvious. The rhododendron-like appearance is so obvious to it. And that, I think, highlights the tremendous correspondence, the concordance of Leadum with our remedy Rhododendron chrysanthemum, which is the yellow rhododendron of the alpine meadows of Siberia. In fact, when I researched the plants to develop the radar database, I found that approximately 50% of them no longer go by the names that we use in our homeopathic literature.
Right.
And in order to accurately identify where they belonged, what family they belonged to, I had to identify their contemporary names. This was a real fun adventure for me. It took a couple of years to do this research and find. And there are actually, I think, were about a dozen remedies that out of the 900 or so plant remedies I researched that I was not able to locate a contemporary identification for. And so it's not clear what the plant actually is. Yeah. Those were all obscure ones that you're never going to find in your practice.
Yeah, sure. Will, one of the things that I've noticed a lot with a lot of the contemporary teachers who are using plant families in their practice, that they very frequently, or almost always maybe, will come up with some very obscure remedy in their cases. And I'm curious, I know that you're exploring the use of botanical families. Are you coming up with the same type of situation where you're coming up with a lot of these more obscure, smaller type remedies?
Well, I certainly do have those, and that's one of the reasons to do this is sometimes you have a case that looks for the world like a pulsatilla case, and pulsatilla's not acting. And you find that a family member of pulsatilla, one of the cases I love to teach is a case of Aquilegia vulgaris, the common columbine of Europe. And it's a case that looked for the world like pulsatilla, but pulsatilla didn't act curatively. And so looking at members of a family is often a way to find these obscure things. But I have to caution that these are the sexy cases, and these are the cases that we're going to teach. So when I look at my own practice and really look at numbers, most of my prescriptions are the polycrests. And not for the reason that most of my prescriptions were the polycrests in my first 5 years of practice. Then it was because my knowledge was limited, and I wasn't a good prescriber, and I would see a case, and it looked like sepia, and I'd give sepia to it. And every now and then I'd have a great success, write home, call my mother, and, feel good about myself. But just as often, or perhaps more often, I gave sepia to a case that needed Lilium tigrinum or Murex or something that I would have found if I had looked at the case more seriously and more carefully. But I do want to caution that with our excitement about small remedies, still the most common prescription in my practice is silica. Second most common is probably sulfur in adults. In children, the most common is calcfos, these big remedies that we run into very, very frequently. I don't want to see that, sometimes we swing the pendulum too far each swing. I think it's important not to throw the polycress out while we run to the small remedies as solutions for our problems.
Well, you mentioned Aquilegia columbine. Uh-huh. Is that canadensis?
Well, there is. The one we have in Armateria medica is Aquilegia vulgaris.
Vulgaris, okay.
Which is
all right.
A common blue columbine of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Aquilegia canadensis is a beautiful plant that grows... it grows wild in the mountains up here, and I think down your way as well in Northern California.
I actually have some in my garden.
The orange one with a kind of yellow center in it.
Beautiful. Yeah, they're gorgeous.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful plants.
Yeah, very, very attractive plants.
Yeah. And, I get intrigued. Who knows if Aquilegia canadensis is a unique remedy into itself or very similar to vulgaris, or we don't know vulgaris very well either.
Yeah.
So this is in my list of potential provings. I've got a couple dozen jars upstairs of of pickled remedies waiting for their provings.
Wow.
And this is one that's in there. Yeah.
Now, well, I've seen that case, that really wonderful case of Aquilesia vulgaris that you have, and I thought maybe could you just share with the group here just a little bit about maybe just that case or what
sure.
you discovered about Aquilesia in general, because I thought that case
sure.
was fascinating.
Well, I'm pulling this off my head, so forgive me if I mess up a few details here, but it was a 17-year-old girl who presented with amenorrhea, I think 6 months of amenorrhea, but a past history of severe menstrual cramps since and PMS since the first onset of menses. And so her PMS was, she just described, it was hard for her to give me a lot of detail. She said she felt, quote, sick, unquote, and had to have a dark room and quiet. For it, not for any particular symptoms at all, but just in general. She would get headaches during that period that were better with a cold cloth on her head. And let's see, then she had these menstrual cramps that were during the period, if I recall right. So she'd have this kind of PMS-y stuff before and then the cramps during the period. She was a very quiet, very meek person and said she doesn't speak up much and had trouble being assertive during the interview and admitted that she always has trouble being assertive. And, it was one of these cases where you just sit with this case and you go, I cannot do anything here except give pulsatilla. This is a case that God and Hahnemann sent me to make me feel good about doing homeopathy again. And so shooting from the hip, you give her pulsatilla and repertorizing the case. Oh, I forgot the most important part. Prior to her period, she would get, with emotion, she'd get really weepy easily at anything. A nice word, a telephone commercial, a movie where the dog comes home. She'd get really weepy easily, and she'd get this lump in her throat with emotion that wouldn't go away when she swallowed. So anyway, you repertorize this up, and pulsatilla comes up. It's missing in a couple of rubrics, but... nothing else comes close. And so I was going to give her pulsatilla. And so I just started describing the remedy to her, and she said, oh, I took that. I said, oh, tell me about that. And she, by the way, that's the best question in homeopathy. If you only have one response to a patient, it's tell me about that. Okay. So she said, well, it's about 6 months ago. I picked it up, from the health food store because it said for menstrual cramps and PMS or something, and she took a couple doses, and she thought maybe it helped her headaches a little bit, but then her periods stopped. Okay, so is that a curative response to a remedy? This is disrupting of the case, and yet, if there's a soccer ball on a field, and you go kick 35 feet to the left of it, nothing happens. You see, so if you're way off with a remedy, you don't touch a case. But if you disrupt a case some way, you were at least mucking around in the right ballpark. So I looked at this and said, well, pulsatilla is clearly not the curative remedy here. But how about something similar to pulsatilla? So we can look at various lists of remedies. We can look at Benninghausen's Concordance and say these are remedies that are similar in action to pulsatilla. Or we can look at any list of related remedies. But one place we can look is at the family. And when you looked at the repertorization, pulsatilla came up first, but somewhere in the top 10, there was also simisifuga and aconite. And if you don't know your botanical families, you can ask Radar to do this, where you can click on pulsatilla and open up the family's tree and say, highlight any other member of this family, highlight all the members of this family, and come back to your repertorization and see that here's pulsatilla number one, simisifuga number five, aconite number three, lit up in the repertorization. See, oh, three members of the same family.
Ranunculaceae, correct?
All Ranunculaceae.
Yeah.
Crowfoot family.
Right.
All showing up in the top 10. And you say, huh, that's intriguing. Maybe that means this is a Ranunculaceae case. And maybe there's a poorly understood member of this family. And the only reason it's not showing up in the top 10 is because it's poorly understood and it belongs in some of these rubrics, but it's not there yet, you see. So then you can go back and you can restrict to the ranunculaceae family. Actually, you can do a little interesting exercise with Radar 9 now. You can click and say, instead of analyzing by remedy, give me an analysis by family. And now on the repertory graph, instead of remedies across the top, are families across the top. And you can see that the ranunculaceae as a group fits the whole case. Every symptom of the case fits one ranunculaceate or another. And so all those blocks light up. And it's the only family that covers the whole case. So, you know, you can double-click on the name of that family, and now you see the repertorization limited to members of the ranunculaceae. And you can see Pulsatilis, Emesifuga, Aconite, Staphysagria, you know, a number of small, poorly understood ranunculaceates. And when I do that, then I like to do a small remedies weighting on it, because I already have determined that a big ranunculaceate doesn't fit, or if I haven't determined that yet, I'm trying to ask, is there a poorly understood one that fits the case? So do a small remedies weighting, and boom, up to the four jumps on Aquilegia with, I think it had six of the symptoms of the case, which is intriguing because I think it only has 15 rubrics in the whole repertory. And
I have to say that was really an unbelievable case. I was very impressed by that, and how clearly it matched, how you were able to come to the remedy, how clearly it matched the case once you found it. I mean,
yeah, well, you know, when I took that case, I didn't have these tools, and it was harder to work with. I think watching, when I first prepared that case and said, let's see how, you know, after consulting with Radar 9 and some of the family's analysis tools it has, I said, let's put that case in, let's plug it in, and see if these tools help me find the remedy faster than it took me back when I saw the case originally. And it popped right up, you know. I mean, I was so thrilled, you know, saying, hey, these tools work, you know. These tools do what a lot of grunt work did back a few years ago. So.
Well, Will, you know, I have, as always, many more questions that I'd love to ask, but I think it's I should open it up to the general group and let them ask some questions. So let me go ahead and unmute the call.
Sure.
Thank you so much for a really scholarly explanation of so many different aspects of this part of homeopathic practice. So thank you so much for that. Hold on.
Thanks, Kim.
So hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hi there.
Anybody have a question they'd like to ask Dr. Taylor?
I do. Hey, Will.
Yeah.
John Barry out here in Utah.
Hi, John.
By the way, the fly fishing is great on the Provo.
Oh, yeah.
I was fishing Saturday. But, you know, in your practice, you know, I've only been full-time for a year, and, you know, all these polycrests are just wonderful. They just keep doing marvelous things.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I have a tendency to see that so far the majority of the remedies I've been given are plants. Have you found that to be or am I just where I am now?
Well, no, I think that's true. I think that we have more plants than minerals in the Materia Medica. So, you know, just to start there, we got more of them. You know, I'm intrigued that there may be regional variations. You know, when I practiced in Maine, I was in a very small town, in the sticks, took a particular kind of person to live there and enjoy it, not want to move away, was near the salt air. And, you know, I had a particular, you know, I have a feeling that my most commonly prescribed remedies may be different than someone living in the Southwest. You know, and this is a place where it gets over 65, you know, you party. So I don't think we had many lachecists stick around. The laxatives stick around. Arsenicum, you know, wouldn't stick around, right? They'd move somewhere warm. it's an intriguing thing that way. But the other thing is that we do have to be kind of careful sometimes of our personal preferences, you know. And I know that I find plants more easily. I think it's because I'm attracted to them. So sometimes I have to be careful and say, oops, maybe that's me, you know, who wants to see a plant for a remedy here, because I find them attractive, you know. And the mineral remedies are a little bit, you know, and they're not quite so pretty usually. And the nosodes, they're just plain gross.
Thank you.
I like that. Will, any other questions?
Yes, Will. This is Kayla in Colorado.
Hi, Kayla.
Hi. Hi, Kim.
Hey, Kayla.
I have a question. You know, when I was first studying herbalism, we were taught that arnica was good when the skin wasn't broken and calendula was more appropriate if the skin was broken.
Uh-huh.
And I've kind of seen that come up homeopathically also.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's something you've seen.
I think that's a wonderful question and a wonderful observation, Kayla. You know, calendula is proving is terrible. And actually, James Tyler Kent, you go read on calendula in his lectures, and first thing he says is the proving that we have on calendula is next to useless. So we basically fall back on using it on the recommendations of the herbalists who, Hale talked about this. He said, if the doctrine is, if the principle of similars is really a universal phenomenon, and these botanists are getting cures with a plant, it must be acting according to the principle of similars. And we see again and again when we do a proving, for example, we do the proving of euphrasia, eye bright, and we see all these eye symptoms. We go, oh, duh, it's not surprising. And all these botanists have unknowingly been using the principle of similars for years in treating with it. So I think we find the same with calendula. But it's a fascinating remedy, and it's one I'm getting to appreciate more and more. It certainly has it shares with arnica the contusion. It shares the effects on infection and its symptoms in erysipelas and blood poisoning, sepsis are very similar to those of arnica. But what we find is in contusions that involve a tear of the skin, calendula is much more commonly indicated. For example, in labor, often for a contused perineum, arnica is prescribed and often is very ineffective. But calendula addresses that same contused feeling much more effectively. It's usually associated with either obvious or not so obvious tears to the tissue. I remember my son Caleb had a wonderful calendula moment. He was at a homeschool park day, and he was playing with the teeter-totters. And he was doing that game where you stand up on your end and your friend's on sitting down on the other, and when they're way up in the air, you jump off, And so he jumped off, and she clanged into the ground and, of course, bruised her tailbone. And there's a nice Ruta prescription there. But Caleb didn't jump far enough back, and so the teeter-totter, the board came up and smacked him in the forehead and split his forehead open. And Mary was, who's a better homeopath than she thinks she is, quickly whipped out the calendula, both as tincture topically and a 30C orally. And he's healed up without it. He's very disappointed. He wanted a bruise like Mad Max on his forehead there, but he's healed it beautifully. So these contusions associated with skin laceration, I think very often calendula is the appropriate remedy.
Iris fluid,
and the next remedy I'd throw you for a fix if you wanna play with this a little more is Bellus, and really
yes.
Dig into the descriptions of Bellus because it's a very neglected remedy.
Right, the gardener's remedy. We use that a lot for sure.
Yeah, I found some years ago I inherited a triathlete in my practice, and he started sending me a bunch of his friends. A lot of them use arnica after their races. And I'd suggested to him once, why don't you try Bellus instead, just as an experiment. They've all gone over to using Bellus. And, this trauma from overexertion may fit Bellus better than arnica. Again, actually, Bellus has had a contemporary proving with Peter and Edeltraud Friedrich in Germany, but it's not been translated to English yet. So if you read Deutsch, it'd be worth digging into and looking at in depth.
Okay, well, why don't we have one question, because we're kind of running out of time here. So one final question.
This is Dawn in Australia.
Hello.
Hi, Kim.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, Will.
Hi.
Do you know if there's anything around about Australian plants in particular, if anybody has done a lot of work on the different kinds of eucalyptus trees and so on?
No. We've got very few things from down under in Esoteric Medica. There's so many snakes and spiders. Of course, we have a couple Australian spiders in the Materia Medica, Latrodectus hasseltii, and then the funnel web spider, the Sydney funnel web, is in there. Oh, and the Australian whiteback. But clearly we need more, and I don't know of any plants from down under that have been looked at all. You're really an untouched and territory, and there must be, you know, in the 1860s, Edwin Moses Hale became really intrigued with the Native American use of plants and started doing provings of these, Simisifuga, Gelsamium, inspired by their successes. And, you know, really finding that the indications based on provings were very similar to the indications of traditional use. Kind of proving again that when something is effective, it was by the principle of similars, even if we didn't identify that to be the case. So I would imagine there must be a tremendous traditional herbal knowledge to tap down there to start you out in looking at some of these plants, you know.
Well, Agathis australis, that's from New Zealand?
From New Zealand. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
That's the tallest tree in the world, I guess, evergreen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about marsupials? Have we done anything?
Well, let's see. We've got from South America, we've got Muir did the Brazilian tree porcupine, which is a marsupial, Sphingurus. But I'm not sure I know of any others that are
okay. Not. Well, Sorry, go ahead, Will.
Didn't somebody do duckbill platypus? But I don't think it's well described.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I guess it's a huge area, Australia.
Yeah.
So, Dawn, you'll have to start getting going right away.
Oh, I know.
Hey.
No, and I know I watched the crocodile hunter down there, you know, and you know, what's his name, Steve Irwin, and look at some of the snakes this guy plays with, and go, oh my God, we got to have that snake. These Australian snakes, they're wonderful things.
Okay, so well, first of all, let me thank everyone for joining us on the call, and of course, Dr. Taylor, thank you so much for another wonderful call.
Thank you.
Let me just remind everybody that Dr. Taylor will be teaching in Oak Brook, Illinois, on October 2nd and 3rd. The title of the talk is Plant Families, Classical Homeopathic Perspective, and that's in Oak Brook, Illinois. And if you want more information about that, you can call 708-447-2468. Everyone want to say a big thank you to Dr. Taylor?
Thank you
very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Take care, everybody.
Thanks.
You all take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Kim.